is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Post-growth and degrowth, Tim Jackson and Lawrence Keeser.
Good lives do not have to cost the earth.
The stock markets, banks, every business and every person wants to grow more and buy. Will we wait for the great collapse or plan our way back down the mountain?
From the UK, Professor Tim Jackson talks about his new book, Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. Lawrence Keeser from Zurich takes it further, degrowth plan decline coupled with increasing well-being.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you!
The pandemic, jobs crash, weird politics, these are strange times. If we're all twisting into a new society, maybe, could it be better? Right up to the minute comes out a new book from respected economist Dr. Tim Jackson. It is called Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. Tim Jackson is professor of sustainable development and director of the Center for Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. After serving as economist advising the UK government on sustainability, Tim's book Prosperity Without Growth made a bit of a splash and made a few people cranky. Oh, and Tim's other hobby is writing plays for the BBC. Tim Jackson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's a huge pleasure to be with you.
Well, the book is not what I expected. There are no formulas and balance sheets in here. You're an economist, for God's sake. I wanted your solution for the future. Instead, we find a box of lives and what life means. But maybe that is what economy really should be about.
Well, I think that was part of the point that I was making. I mean, if you want those solutions, they're kind of hidden there in Post-Growth. They're much more explicit, actually, in Prosperity Without Growth, the book that you mentioned, which was written for a policy audience. It was written, as you said, for the UK government. And indeed, it did ruffle a few feathers because it dared to think about questioning economic growth. One of the strange things about that book was actually not how poorly received it was by the government that it was written for, but how well received it was by a much wider audience, a wider audience who didn't really want formulae, didn't even sometimes want charts and figures, didn't need to understand economics as a set of equations, but could understand economics as a set of stories. And that's really what I tried to do in Post-Growth, was to tell some of those stories and to relate them to human beings and to provide what I think is this enormous resource, a resource of the thinking of generations of wise women and men who could actually help us at this point in time to shape an economy that's fit for purpose and give us some sense of our journey out of the crisis of the last year.
Yes, it's time to call the ghosts of our elders. We're in trouble.
I guess you could put it that way. And sometimes the very real presence of our contemporary younger generation, who I also call on from time to time in Post-Growth.
In 2010, you delivered a TED Talk. I don't know if you're aware of it, but you got over 200,000 views on YouTube on that, and it's still building.
I think actually on the TED site itself, it may even be more than that, because TED sort of embeds itself in various different ways. Yeah, it has had a lot of views, and it's quite strange that people still like it, talk about it, and refer to it. You know, in a way, that TED Talk, I was trying to do a very similar thing. I was trying to kind of make our dilemmas accessible to people and to relate it to stories about our lives and to offer people an alternative, a sense that there is actually a way to build progress, social progress, in a sense that's meaningful for ordinary people everywhere.
Well, for me, your book came out like one of those fire alarms that has a glass door and a little hammer hanging on a chain beside it to break open in case of fire, because now, after an economy that was wrenched out of shape and a heartbreaking pandemic for many people, and nothing done about the climate, the alarm is going off and it is time to wake up, and we repeatedly fail to respond. Do you think we're stuck in a kind of state of shock, almost like a medical shock where people don't react after an accident?
I think it is a little bit like that. It's a little bit like a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder in a way. I mean, there was a series of different kind of stages of that. I think in a year ago, or just over a year ago, when the WHO, the World Health Organization, declared a global pandemic and governments kind of rushed to respond to that, we were thrust very quickly into a very strange world, one that we didn't recognize, one that our parents didn't recognize, one that had not been seen really probably in at least 100 years, and one in which we had to respond, I think, from a position of weakness. And that weakness, to me, was something that I wanted to explore. Why were health systems so unprepared for a pandemic like that? Why were our lives organized in a way that made us particularly vulnerable? Why was it so hard, in fact, to protect the livelihoods of the very people who saved our lives, the nurses, the distribution workers, the carers, the cleaners, even at times in a pandemic that spread itself through the surfaces that we touched? And these were the people whose livelihoods had become less and less secure under capitalism over several decades. And to me, you know, that's the point in a way that I want to really bring through as a lesson from this dreadful and often tragic crisis, is that we must and should and indeed can do better in protecting the livelihoods of people who are absolutely central to society, people who in some sense capitalism just forgot.
There's a great story in your book about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's an early candidate for the presidency, and this is, of course, before his assassination. He goes to the University of Kansas and speaks to a group of young students. And what does he bring out but probably the most boring subject in the world for them, the gross domestic product? Why would he do something so out of place?
You know, that really fascinated me, that story. Why on earth was he talking economics in the first speech of his presidential campaign? Why was he talking about an indicator, this kind of arcane indicator of economic progress in a speech that was supposed to thrust him into the highlight of a quite difficult presidential campaign, because he was standing against an incumbent Democrat president at that time? And the understanding that I had of this, and I traced it through, I followed up actually the person who wrote that speech, a man called Adam Walensky, and asked him about the circumstances of that, because I was absolutely fascinated by it. Those words that he wrote about the GDP have become a sort of, you know, a flagship speech in some ways for people like me who've been thinking about growth, thinking about the economy, and in particular thinking about the conflict between our economic expansion and the finite nature of our planet, because he articulated exactly that point in 1968, 53 years ago, in a presidential campaign. So I've been fascinated by that speech ever since it was, a recording of it was unearthed from a basement in the university, I think, 20 years ago or something. And what Adam Walensky told me when I was asking him about it was that it spoke to absolutely core concerns that Kennedy had at that time, that he did have a love of the environment, a love of nature. He spent a lot of time in nature as a young man, that he had an absolute concern about social inequality and about the dreadful poverties of not just of material affluence, but actually of meaning and purpose and dignity in America. And he spent a lot of time in that campaign, you know, going around the country, looking at those circumstances, identifying some of the causes of that poverty, and talking to the people who were not the rich and powerful, not the good and the great, not the famous, but actually the ordinary working people of America, and understanding the nature of the malaise that was affecting society at that point in time. 1968 was a tumultuous year. You know, it was comparable in many ways to the year 2020. And Kennedy was an extraordinary presidential candidate. As you mentioned, it was an ill-fated campaign. He was assassinated on the evening of the California primary on the 4th of June. And that promise that he held out of a different kind of politics, a different kind of progress, a real sense of connection to people and a protection of our planet, that had to go into recess for quite a long period of time, partly because, of course, he was cut short in his prime. But it remains for us today, it remains an extraordinary example of vision and foresight, and has much that could teach us, not just how to survive the pandemic, but how to tackle the issues that we face in relation to the environment.
Ah, the America that might have been. You have a serious reputation as an economist in the UK and globally. Are colleagues in your field coming around to Herman Daly's view that the economy is, quote, a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment?
Well, you know, I think they are a bit. I mean, Herman is a, you know, tremendous visionary figure in this field, and, you know, fought the ground on which others now can now walk because of what he did in the past. And when he started talking in those terms four or more decades ago, it was a difficult territory. Growth was the order of the day. The expansion of the economy was everything. The business of business was business, as the Milton Friedman School, Chicago School would have said. And to think otherwise was a kind of heresy. And so Herman really did kind of, you know, break that ground back in the day and created the idea that we have to think beyond growth. And I think one of the interesting things and one of the reasons why there is a bigger crowd of people who are prepared to entertain that idea is that in the last 40 or 50 years, growth has subsided. The rate of growth has fallen in advanced economies. The idea that growth can go on forever is no longer something that we can really rely on. So you could say that, you know, if you were in any sense a risk-averse person or someone who had a sense of precaution, you would begin to think about what a post-growth economy might look like, because all of that growth that we took for granted a few decades ago just has not been there, wasn't there even before the pandemic, and may not come back in the form that we, or politicians at least, would like it to do. And economists have been very, very slow to pick that point up, I think. They've been, you know, much more determined to try to keep growth going by loose monetary policy and incentives of one kind and another, and much less observant, I suppose you could say, about the conditions under which we now live. And the conditions of the economy going forward are ones where we do have to pay attention to those who care for us. We do have to think about the structure of our society, and we do have to protect the integrity of our natural resources. Those are all things that suddenly make Herman Daly's idea of a steady state actually a really fascinating place to revisit.
Wall Street and the city are riding high these days. Billionaires rise into stratospheric wealth. Isn't it a bit early to be writing about life after capitalism?
Yep, it certainly is. I mean, one of my chapters is called Who Killed Capitalism? And the most obvious answer to that question is nobody. Thank you very much. Capitalism is alive and well. And it's in Wall Street, as you say, and it's in the city in London, and it's in Frankfurt, wherever the financial center of Europe will move to. And it's in Davos, the World Economic Forum. And it's in some senses in the stock market sense of capitalism. It has had a bumper year over the last year, and yet we were faced with fundamental economic difficulties that go right to the heart of that capitalistic economic model, and we haven't found solutions for them yet. In the middle of the crisis, actually, we almost abandoned certain key aspects of capitalism altogether. Governments intervened massively to protect people's lives and to protect people's livelihoods and to build hospitals and to move supply chains that we needed for PPE, the protective equipment that saved the lives of nurses. All of these things, actually, and indeed the money system that allowed them to happen, were things that were essentially almost outlawed in the version of capitalism that preceded this particular crisis. that will change, you know, that we will see actually that our ideological commitment, the narrowing down of our policies to what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, is now in a different place, and we have more options open to us. And I don't know whether that's immediately life after capitalism. As you say, you know, the stock market is really still riding very high off all the money that was pumped in to protect it from the pandemic. But our economy, the basis of our lives, the livelihoods of some of the most important people in society are still under threat. And capitalism, pure capitalism, I don't think has the answers to that crisis. And that's why I think we have to think beyond it.
Below the layer of the multi-billionaires and the affluent, there are millions of people who feel we have neither prosperity nor growth. They feel shut out. And I wonder, do we still have enough social capital left to plan a new economy and build something? Or will things just spin out of control into hardship and the unknown? What do you think, Tim Jackson?
I believe that we can save that social capital. I think that's, you know, to me, it's not quite an article of faith, but it's certainly a useful place to start from. And it's part, in a way, of what I was trying to do in post-growth, was to say, as Kennedy did, actually, in 1968, that these social values are the things that bind us together, that this social capital is what we build society from, that the idea of social progress is not just about having more and more. And neither are we as a society just a collection of competitive, aggressive, acquisitive individuals. The most important things in our prosperity relate to our health and our relationships and the quality of our lives and the strength of our communities. And actually, again, that was one of the other extraordinary lessons that we learned through the pandemic, is that when things get really difficult, communities can come together. We can reorganize the way that we care for each other. Huge volunteer systems of people supporting each other through the pandemic, providing support to those who are lonely or isolated, bringing care and medicines to those who needed it. I believe those social values still exist, Alex. I don't think that we have managed, even capitalism has not managed to erode them away completely. And I think people's faith in those abilities also remains strong. But that's not to trivialize what you're pointing to, which is this huge sense of alienation, atomization, almost social breakdown and divisiveness that has characterized the lives and the politics of the last few years. And to me, that's the sense of urgency that I have. I believe if we don't confront these issues and find solutions through them and draw on the strength of those social values, then the kind of chaos that you were alluding to is our destiny. But we have a choice there, and that choice is profound, but it offers many, many possibilities for, you know, I think not just as good a world as we had before, but actually one that is far better, because it isn't built on a spurious promise of always having more and more, but allows us the foundation to create more and more meaningful relationships with each other and to redefine our sense of purpose in life. Exactly, in fact, as Kennedy was talking about at the University of Kansas.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the well-known UK ecological economist, Dr. Tim Daxon. In your book, you spend a little time talking about something, labor productivity, and that mystifies most of us. What does it mean?
This is an economic concept, and it's not that easy to grasp, and yet somehow we see its implications all around it. So labor productivity is a measure of how much output, economic output, you can produce as a worker in each hour of your time. And one of the key aspects of capitalism, actually, is to try and increase that number. to make us all more and more productive, to produce more and more things, to make our time more efficient. And there's some places where you can think, well, that's a pretty good thing to do because I don't really, you know, enjoy washing sheets by hand or mixing concrete with a spade. We've got some really nice, clever devices that can do that for us and can lift our lives out of drudgery. And that surely that's got to be a good thing. And then you could take that same principle and you apply it to, you know, the making of things. And you say, well, all the manufacturing needs that we have, wouldn't that be better done with robots? And of course, it might be better, more quickly done with robots. We might be able to produce more things with those robots. And that would mean, first of all, more material stuff going through our economy. And secondly, more machines in order to make those material things to go through the economy. And thirdly, less jobs for people. Is that a good thing? And then in another category, you ask the question, well, what about something like care? Is it really a sensible thing to ask all of our nurses to see more and more patients on their nurse round, more doctors to see more people during the day, shorter appointments for everybody? Is it better if we have bigger and bigger class sizes for our teachers to teach? Do we want our craftsmen just to be making shoddy products because it's quicker and they can sell it cheap and it's thrown away soon? Or is it better actually to protect the value of our time in the economy? And this is actually a fundamental challenge in capitalist economics. It was identified by an economist, the late William Baumol, who wrote about it over a kind of 30 or 40 year career. And most recently in a book which was subtitled Why Computers Got Cheaper and Healthcare Didn't. And it's because the capitalist economy favors that growth in labor productivity that sits well with making lots of stuff fast. And it doesn't sit well with protecting the time that care workers put into care, that craftsmen put into making beautiful projects, and that our creative artists put into improving the quality of our lives. So all of those sectors that actually are fundamental to the quality of our lives begin to suffer. And that's why something as opaque as labor productivity growth is a really kind of important thing to get our heads around, to understand that that's a structural feature of capitalism that we have to be able to change if we want to address this economy of care that could create a better society.
On another topic, around the world, there's a real estate boom which translates into a housing crisis for many. My kids can never afford to buy a home now. It's just out of reach. And I worry this decade could see a new wave of homelessness.
Things like the housing bubble, you know, tend to be essentially what economists call rent-seeking behavior. We try to squeeze as much value out of other people and out of natural resources as we can by claiming ownership to land, to buildings, to structure, to companies. And this rent-seeking behavior is deeply divisive because it means that those who have access to that property can get very much richer, and those who have no access are, you know, off the property ladder. They have nowhere to start from. The house prices become too high. And when that becomes the basis for our economic success, and we tend to drive it forward with policies that are purely destructive and encouraging that speculative rent-seeking behavior. And it's created actually one of the most worrying divides, or one of the divides that I personally find most worrying, the divide between an older generation that does have a sense of ownership of property and a younger generation who are looking at years of never being able to afford such a luxury. And when you divide the older generation from the younger generation, you begin to divide society itself. So I think that's it's a deeply destructive trend. But it's actually, we have to recognize, I think, that it's a trend that has been to some extent not just allowed, but supported and encouraged by the economic policies that have made the kind of speculative lending that drives up asset prices acceptable in our society. It might be acceptable in purely economic terms. It's totally unacceptable in terms of its social implications. So it's a profound problem that we have to confront, I think, and begin to address.
Some parts of America have a different answer. They're marching sternly toward the past. In Texas, under a new law, you can just buy a gun without a permit or any background check and strap it on your waist and go out shopping like it's the old West. And we see leanings towards more authoritarian governments in some Eastern EU states even. So I'm wondering if we try to go back towards the past because the future seems impossible.
I don't think it works out well for us. That's my fear. And then to some extent, I would say that much of my work is motivated by that fear and by a sense that there is actually a much better world. There's a better sense of prosperity. There's a better sense of who we are as human beings that doesn't see us as purely competitors in a vicious struggle for existence, but sees us as collaborators in the relationships that form society. And that actually through that different vision of ourselves, I believe we can achieve a better quality of life, a richer quality of life. It may not be one in which everybody can aspire to be those billionaires that you spoke of earlier who have profited so well from the crisis. It may not be a world full of Elon Musk's and Jeff Bezos's. It may not be a world in which we all consume and see our sole purpose as being consumption. But to my mind, that is an anxiety-ridden, pathological place of denial that capitalism has forced upon us. It has reduced our expectations of what it means to be human. It hasn't enriched them. And I feel profoundly that actually beyond what appear to us to be limits in terms of material things, there is an almost unlimited territory in terms of the expansion of the human spirit, of human potential, that we can access actually quite profound states of satisfaction through activity, through engaging our skills in meeting challenges, through being fulfilled through our work and through our relationships, and sometimes even through very simple activities like exercise and contemplation and meditation. And that this huge breadth of human experience is itself being curtailed by the dream of having more and more material stuff. And while that dream is, you know, it's very understandable, and it's particularly understandable for the poorest in society, after a certain point, it just leads us astray, and it becomes a distraction from this richer land, which I fully believe actually is the ultimate goal of human progress, to expand our potential, to expand our horizons, to expand our consciousness, to expand our care for other people, and in doing so, actually to find out what it means to be human. And that in a way is a, you know, it's a very powerful vision, because it isn't restricted by class or gender or color. It isn't restricted by your income. It is actually a place where everybody has, and I believe everybody has the right to, the ability to see growth, if you like, of a different kind, of a kind that expands our humanity and that creates a world in which, in fact, everybody has the ability to flourish as human beings.
We are starting to run out of time, so I've just got two quick questions for you. The first is degrowth not in your toolbox for post-growth solutions?
I think the work of the degrowth community has been profoundly useful, and it has placed the question of growth firmly in the headlights, and I think that's a very good thing. I prefer the term post-growth, partly because I think we're already there, and partly because it has a sense, actually, that possibility of a life after capitalism that isn't reliant on growth can be that richer place that I was describing. And I think many of the people who talk about degrowth would agree with that.
Yes, their emphasis is on well-being, and that is what you were talking about as well. Where do you see yourself going next, Tim?
A couple of places, I guess. One is identifying these structural difficulties within capitalism really focuses your mind on how little we know about an economy that doesn't work in that way. So my research centre, actually, in the UK, and the work that we've been doing there has really been trying to articulate that question of what this post-growth economy looks like. How does it operate? How does ownership work in it? How do debts work in it? How does the government work in it? What's the relationship between our investment and our consumption? You know, deeply economic questions, which aren't everybody's cup of tea by any means, but actually are quite fundamental to thinking about the economy that we want in the future. And the second, I think, is driven really by my passionate belief in this better, richer, deeper sense of what it means to be human. So it's more of a psychological, social project, and possibly also, you know, to refer back to